From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Tracy Wilkinson, correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, and Tom DeFrank of the National Journal. Our moderator is CBS radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. Tensions between the United States and Iran heightened as an unmanned drone was shot down over the Straits of Hormuz, and U.S. President Donald Trump grapples with his administration and the U.S. Congress over a proper response. President Xi Jinping made the first Chinese state visit to North Korea in 14 years, this in advance of trade talks with the United States before the upcoming G20 summit in Japan. President Trump kicked off his 2020 presidential reelection campaign, sounding many of the same notes that won over supporters in 2016. And the United Nations released its report on the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, indicating involvement at the highest levels of the Saudi government and prompting a clear response from American lawmakers. Panelists, welcome. And let's start with the U.S.-Iran tensions this week. I think it's been as close to a crisis as anything that has faced the Trump administration so far, as Iran announced its intention at the beginning of the week to enrich uranium beyond the limits of the 2015 nuclear deal. And then a U.S. unmanned aircraft was shot down in what the U.S. says was international airspace. What Iran is saying was an aircraft that had strayed into Iranian airspace. And then there are these reports of President Trump ordering and then calling off an airstrike in retaliation. I know that we are working with breaking news minute by minute, but Tracy, I'll start with you. What do we know as we speak right now?
Well, the signals actually from the administration have been very mixed. Until these reports of airstrikes being ordered, we had seen a very hard line coming from Secretary of State Pompeo, the National Security Advisor John Bolton. Yet we had Trump saying that the shooting down of the U.S. drone might have been a mistake, that it was a fly in the ointment. He almost seemed to be apologizing for the Iranians, which was very odd. And then later we hear reports that he had ordered airstrikes against Iran that were then called off. So it's very confusing to know exactly what this administration's next steps are going to be. Remember, this all started, I guess, when the United States pulled out of the 2015 nuclear deal.
Absolutely.
And then more recently, there have been attacks on some oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman, which Iran denies having done, but which the U.S. blames on Iran. And so it's kind of gone tit for tat here, each side escalating a bit, but not to an extreme. Even those tanker attacks didn't kill anybody, didn't cause great damage. It seemed that Iran, if they were responsible, the Iranians were trying to say, hey, we're still here and we can still strike back. A message more than anything. And I think these reports about U.S. contemplating airstrikes might also be a message to Iran. So we have to wait and see what's going to happen, as Trump is so fond of saying.
I'm saying we have to wait and see. Tom, I want to dig a little deeper on this idea of ordering strikes, because this was a done deal. There were planes in the air, there were ships on the move for this particular airstrike, and it was pulled back at, let's not say the last minute, because you don't know exactly, but it was well on its way and then pulled back. Is this a tactical move? Is this a psychological move? What do you think is the genesis of this type of strategy?
Well, it could be both. It could be a strategy. It could just be impulsive. You know, the president is always talking about being strong. We've got to be strong, or he needs to be perceived as being strong. And maybe he was unhappy about blowback the other day when he was saying this was just probably somebody loose and stupid making a mistake, and the president saying, I can't believe that this was done intentionally. And maybe some of his most conservative supporters said to him, Mr. President, you're looking weak, so he needed to be tough. I think the real problem is there doesn't seem to be a consistent strategy towards Iran, and part of the reason for that is there is a split at the highest levels of the Trump government. You've got John Bolton, who Tracy has pointed out, he is a super hawk on Iran, and for years, long before he worked for Trump, Bolton has urged a military strike to take out Iran's nuclear.
It's basically a defining principle of his career,
right,
and his philosophy.
Right, and it's been very ironic over the last several months that President Trump looks like he's the moderating influence among his Secretary of State and his National Security Advisor. On the other hand, as I said earlier, President Trump hates being in situations where he looks like he's not strong. Maybe this was a psychological message. Maybe this was a testosterone-laden message. It's too early to know. But the one thing I think we all can probably agree on is this is a dangerous situation.
Trump seems to thrive on unpredictability, his own unpredictability. I think he sees it as a strength, as something that works in his favor. And there's a subtle difference between unpredictability and volatility. And maybe it isn't even such a subtle difference. There's maybe a big difference when you're talking about a situation like this, and presidents have to lean on their advisors. Who really has the ear of the president at this point? Do we really know? Is there any indication? And are those people inside the White House? Is he listening to John Bolton or is he listening to Sean Hannity?
It's hard to say. It's been said about Trump, who has his ear, is the last person in the room, the last person he talks to. But I think you're right. I think he's very driven by cable news, what he hears on Fox TV and elsewhere. I think he sometimes listens to Bolton. I think he often listens to Pence, the vice president. But it's hard to get in his mind to know how he makes these decisions. As you say, he's very unpredictable, and he values that. He says, I'm keeping my foes guessing. But the problem is he's also keeping his allies guessing. And allies need a certain consistency from the president of the United States, and they're not getting that.
You have Iran now, who is being squeezed. I mean, there is no doubt about the fact. No one is disputing the fact that the sanctions are working, that the economy is being squeezed, and there is the consensus is that these moves by Iran are maybe out of the pain that are being caused by this. Is the ultimate purpose of these sanctions and of pulling out of this 2015 agreement, is it to get a better agreement, or is it to provoke a war that will cause regime change in Iran?
Well, I think if John Bolton were the president, it would be the latter. Bolton wants regime change. He wants the mullahs gone. He wants all of them gone, replaced with freedom-loving Iranians, and that's not going to happen. There is so much about this that is ironic. I mean, it was very ironic the other day to have reports out of the State Department that State Department diplomats were urging the Iranians to adhere to the terms of the 2015 deal, forgetting for the moment that President Trump pulled the United States out of that deal. So you've got all this kind of craziness across the board, and it's very high stakes stuff. I think the president truly does not want a war. He wants to look tough and strong and resolute, but he doesn't want a war, because he knows that if you go down this road, especially with Iran as opposed to Syria, Iran is a real big country. You're not going to have a regime change in Iran by taking out some missile batteries. It would probably require ground military action. That's not going to happen,
right.
I don't
believe. The point in terms of who is Trump listening to, remember that Saudi Arabia and Israel are both also stoking this, let's go after Iran. They very much would like to see attacks on Iran. So it may not be in the U.S. interests, but certainly those two countries are egging Trump on this.
You're reading from a script here, and to bring that, this is, as always, very complicated math when we're talking about anything that has to do with the Middle East. But the prospect of a shooting war, a hot war with Iran, and I'll give you the last word on this, Tracy, if you're going to rate it on a scale somewhere from highly unlikely to right around the corner, if you will, where would you put this, the possibility?
Somewhere in between. I don't think it's highly likely right now because, as we were saying, Trump doesn't want war. Let's remember that the tanker war in the 1980s, which was a very, you know, the U.S. involvement was very minimal, and yet dozens of people were killed. So a full-out shooting war, I think, no one wants. And I think they will be able to avoid that. But it's a dangerous and volatile situation where any mistake could really explode into something quite dire.
As we say, we're working with breaking news here. And as you say, we will see and report back as events occur. Let's move on to U.S.-China trade talks and the movements of Chinese President Xi over the course of the last week. President Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi are agreed to meet prior to the G20 summit to discuss how to end what's come to be a year-long trade war of exchange of sanctions and threats of more sanctions. And meanwhile, President Xi was in North Korea on the first state visit to that country, as we said, in 14 years. Let's start with President Trump and his relationship with Xi, which President Trump characterizes it as a warm relationship, and they're great friends. We know that he deals in negotiations based on personal relationship. He is promising a great deal in the works. If it is a great deal, what would be the issues that are on the table? What would make it a great deal?
A great deal would be, I think, for the Chinese to admit that they've been stealing American intellectual property for years, and they're not going to do that anymore. I think that's not going to happen. There might be some happy talk there. But the Chinese, I think, are going to do what they have to do to keep some modicum of stability and sanity in this process. But the Chinese are not going to capitulate to the United States. So what is a good deal? I think they'll probably buy more soybeans, buy more agricultural products, and agree to not do this or not do that. There's so much posturing going on within the U.S. government that I try not to pay attention to what all that spin is all about. But I was struck the other day by a very famous businessman named David Rubenstein, who I once met in the Carter administration when he was an obscure deputy policy advisor for President Carter. He remains today the smartest guy I've ever dealt with. And he said on CNBC in recent days that there will be a deal. It'll probably take six more months. It won't happen until the end of the year. But there will be a deal because both China and the United States need a deal. And he said, I'm not smart enough to know what's going to be in the deal, but there will be a deal so both sides can claim victory. And so I think all of this posturing, I think Trump and Xi were going to meet in Osaka, and this has been known for months, and now the president announced it 3 or 4 days ago. This is all part of the spin. I think there will be a deal, and economic Armageddon will be averted, and everybody kind of knows about it.
Tracy, I want you to respond to that and mix in the idea that you have the meeting between the North Korean leader and the Chinese leader, which adds to this calculus of that relationship bearing on the trade relations and the nuclear negotiations that are going on with the United States. So sort of mix those two issues in.
Yeah, Trump was a little, it wasn't completely certain that Trump was going to go to Osaka, him having just been to Japan on another visit. But when he saw that Xi was meeting with Kim Jong-un, then he was getting himself to Osaka. He wants to see Xi. It's a couple of things. Xi can now come into a meeting with Trump, having just been with Kim and possibly offering a message, making it appealing to Trump to talk to Xi because she's just been with Kim, maybe some progress on denuclearization. The other issue, trade, I think Xi is showing Trump that China is very capable of making alliances with other countries. And if the United States is going to play really hardball, China will turn elsewhere. And I think that's the message he's trying to convey.
We're going to have to take a break right there. We'll come back with more issues in the news. Issues in the News is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, go ahead and check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Tracy Wilkinson, correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor for the National Journal, and I'm Michael Williams, CBS Radio contributor. Panel, let's move on to the Trump campaign kickoff. President Trump kicked off the campaign for his 2020 reelection bid with one of his signature rallies in Orlando, Florida, a key battleground state in the 2020 presidential elections. Tom, to me, I would have called it, if it was an album, I'm old enough to call them an album still, Donald Trump's greatest hits, which would be immigration, crime, coal, and Clinton. Did you see anything different?
No, I don't, Michael. It's just, to me, it was, to use an old cliche, deja vu all over again.
Yeah.
Because you would have thought that Hillary Clinton is Trump's opponent this time in 2020, as in 2016. It was Trump's greatest hits.
And I saw a great tweet that said, someone said that I'm watching the Trump campaign kickoff and I'm beginning to think that Clinton will not win in 2020. And it was just brilliant.
Well, she won't win because she's not on the ballot.
Exactly.
But he still believes that Hillary Clinton and her partisans are still fertile targets of opportunity to keep his base excited. I mean, what he's trying to do is keep his, what I consider to be a rock-hard political base of somewhere between 35% and 40% ginned up. And I think it's not a great call because they love him. They believe anything he says. They will support anything he wants to do. And I think those are rock solid people, but the danger the president has in pursuing this strategy is it turns off moderates and independents. And even if he's got a rock solid 40% of the electorate, of the voting public, it's not enough to be reelected. He needs somebody else.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think that the one thing the president is smart about is, well, you have all these national polls that say various Democrats are leading 54% to, or 52% to, or 57% to. He knows that the only number that matters is 270, which is the number of electoral votes counted by states that get you to be the president of the United States. Tracy, as you look at this and you look at the reelection bid, the thing that I know for sure is that the president is now running on his record rather than the record of others. And when you look at that and compare his record now, is that a strength or a weakness? Does it even matter to his base what his record actually is?
It doesn't matter to his base, actually. His record, as Tom was saying, they'll believe whatever Trump tells them. There is a strong economy, and he's taken full credit for that incorrectly, but he could run on that. He doesn't seem to even be running on that yet. He's going back to the old themes of, you know, immigration, frankly, you know, some xenophobic, race-baiting kinds of rhetoric. Let's remember, Trump has been running for re-election since the day he was elected.
Yeah, absolutely.
He literally held 9 victory rallies between the time he won that election in November 2016 and before he moved into the White House in January. So every rally he has had, every stop as president, has essentially been a campaign rally. So this is familiar territory.
It is familiar territory. And Tom, you talked about his base being solidified. I always call them calcified, because there is nothing that can break these people loose. Not the truth, not fact, not fiction. And, you know, he said, you know, he could basically hit a baby with a puppy and nobody would care with that particular group of people. He's also said out loud recently that he doesn't think he needs to get swing voters anymore to win. He says, I don't think I need swing voters. Is he right about that?
No, he's not right about that. Unless somebody jumps in as a third party candidate who can peel off some Democratic support. At the moment, I don't see that happening. As I said before, you cannot, in a two-way race, you cannot win with 40% of the vote, or even 42 or 43% of the vote. And so he needs some swing voters. I mean, President Trump may have forgotten, but the Trump strategists have not. He won this election by a total of 81,000 votes in 3 states, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, his own polls show, that he is trailing in those 3 states. Now, overnight is a lifetime in politics. Those numbers can flip right around many times over between now and in the next 17 months. But at the moment, there is no evidence he's behind in those 3 critical states, and there is no evidence that there are other states he can pick up at the moment. One of his senior campaign officials said to me, "We don't see a Democratic state that we lost last time that we can flip, that we can flip this time." And so if that is true, it's despite the powers of incumbency, which are formidable, despite the fact that he will not have any problems with money. He raised almost $25 million after this one kickoff speech in Orlando. He will be probably even more well-funded than Barack Obama, who raised $1 billion for his last campaign. Despite those formidable advantages, I think President Trump has got a tough row to hoe, and he knows it, or at least his people know it.
I hear those numbers that you talk about for election money. It's just scary.
In his favor, of course, is the Democrats are in disarray, and they have many issues and problems and divisions, and they're going to have to settle eventually on a single candidate. And, you know, it's hard to see who that's going to be that will unify the party. So that's where Trump has some additional advantage.
Well, we had former President Barack Obama talking about Democrats forming a circular firing squad. And we've seen some of that this week with Joe Biden, who's made comments that have been pounced upon by his fellow candidates for president. However, it seems that President Trump has made his decision for the Democratic primary and has focused really on Joe Biden. Is that a positive strategy? Is that a smart thing to do?
I don't know. Some of Trump's people are telling him, don't keep talking about Joe Biden because you're just giving more publicity to him. So I don't know yet if it's the right thing to focus on a single person. And then you have the problem if someone else ends up being the candidate, you've wasted all that energy. So that's a good question. I don't know.
Tom?
Well, I think that's right. Nobody thought this obscure junior senator from Illinois named Barack Obama had a chance to win the nomination 12 years ago, much less much less become president of the United States.
Right.
I mean, things happen.
Well, we have the first Democratic debates coming up next week. And as we all know, television is such a powerful medium, and that will be the opportunity within one question. We can probably eliminate a handful of candidates, and I expect one or two will have ascended from that particular appearance. So I anxiously await those two debates and the opportunity to discuss it with folks like you. Let's move on to the Khashoggi report. The UN independent report on the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi was released, and it revealed a coordinated plot orchestrated by the leadership of Saudi Arabia. It was a report that was quite detailed. I kind of contrasted it to the Mueller report, which had such a vagueness about it. There was no vagueness about this report. It was very pointed and very specific about who was responsible and what happened. Trace, I'll start with you. I found it to be, there was just some gruesome and horrifying detail in there. What was most striking in that report to you?
It was horrific, the details, and they quote audio tapes, and I think that's what I found so chilling,
yeah.
Hearing voices of men discussing how to cut up the body, and then hearing Khashoggi himself being stunned this was happening and saying, how can this happen in an embassy? It was just horrific and chilling. That kind of detail, you know, we've known this, but to have this report formally put it in writing, having, you know, quoting these audio tapes, I thought was especially damning and certainly chilling. And, you know, the UN is calling on a wider investigation, and of course the Saudis are resisting that completely.
Has there been any response, Tom, from the Trump administration, any official response to this report?
They're just saying we're studying it carefully. The president has basically not only signaled behind the scenes, but he has said publicly that the strategic importance of Saudi Arabia cannot be questioned or threatened, and that maybe Mohammed bin Sultan knew about it, maybe he didn't. Mm-hmm. Clearly he did.
Mm-hmm.
The evidence suggests he did. They buy a lot of our military hardware. They're our allies, and basically President Trump has made it clear he's going to give the Saudis a pass on this one, but some of his most strenuous allies, like Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who was an ardent Trump defender, said a few days ago, they did it. We all know they did it. There was a withering cartoon in the Washington Post last week where Mohammed bin Salman comes to the door, and on the door it says House of Saud, S-A-W-E-D.
Wow.
It's a reference to this report. So I think the president would like not to talk about this, and to the extent he can, he won't. But it's I think the president is in a minority here, but he's made his decision, and I don't think he's going to change that.
And there are repercussions beyond this human rights atrocity, which is the Senate is voting against selling more arms to the Saudis right now, in part because of the Khashoggi issue.
Right, and we have that canceled. It is interesting that we have this bipartisan vote, by the way, to limit or cancel the arms sales to the Saudi government in what is a clear rebuke to President Trump and his, I feel, once again, this sort of deference to strongmen, to these authoritarian leaders, and giving them the benefit of the doubt. And some would say it's realpolitik, and others would say it's just flat out deference. And I think it sort of depends on where you stand in relation to what's happening in those moments. But Mohammed bin Salman is a young leader. He was a controversial choice. He sort of played hardball politics to get himself into that position with a lot of skepticism within his own family and within his own country and government. As we finish, I want to ask you, Tracy, is MBS in trouble? Is he in jeopardy?
I don't think so. I think he has consolidated power as in every realm, the military, intelligence. I think domestically in Saudi Arabia, I think he's strong. Now, if he is shunned internationally at some point, that might weaken his hand. But when you have the president of the United States willing to overlook not just the Khashoggi murder, the killings of civilians in the Yemen conflict Saudi Arabia is involved in, then, I mean, it seems like the world is giving him a pass, and I don't think for now he's in much trouble.
Well, that's about all the time we have for this week. Thanks to Tom DeFrank, contributing editor for the National Journal, and Tracy Wilkinson, correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. This program is produced by Kim Lewis. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. And I'm Michael Williams. Thank you for listening.